Hi, welcome to another episode of The Leadership Enigma. Now, we are living and leading in constant change. I'm always saying that, aren't I? And the reality is we've got to somehow navigate the ever-expanding grey space. And the power of information is something that we have to consider. Because doesn't it feel like we're drinking from the fire hose at times? And where are we getting information from? And how are we processing it? And what are we actually doing it? There's the trial lawyer in me. What is the evidence that we're using in order to maybe back up our rationale or our decision making? So easy sometimes before judge and jury. But you've got to come back to me after this short break as I talk to the wonderful Major General Tom Cobbinger-Symes, who is currently the Director for Military Digitization, the UK Strategic Command. You do not want to miss this one.
During constant change, your leadership has never been more important to create a better and more inclusive world. You're listening to The Leadership Enigma, a podcast for the insatiably curious to explore the power of human-centered leadership to create real momentum for positive and sustainable change. Whether you're an entrepreneur, business owner, or corporate executive, each week we speak to global experts, academics, rising stars, ambitious upstarts, and disruptors as we discover that success leaves clues. Now, here's your host, Adam Pacifico.
Well, there we have it. That was the intro. And Tom, it's a massive welcome to the Leadership Enigma. How are you?
Thanks, Adam. Great to be here and very well. Thank you.
Now, I can't do justice to your background, your professional and operational background. So I'm abdicating responsibility over to you. So give us a little bit of a précis of some of the highlights in your mind of your career to date within the forces.
Thanks, Adam. Well, for somebody who's got digitization in the name of their title, I came here by a very strange route. I mean, I'm a pretty normal infantryman. I spent my time on operations, you know, through the 90s in Northern Ireland, and then, of course, Balkans, yeah. Bosnia and Kosovo, and then into the noughties, a lot of work in counterterrorism, and then into, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan and the campaign years of which many of your listeners will be familiar. And so that's a very sort of conventional, straightforward military career. But then I suppose having come back from Afghanistan nearly 10 years ago now, really full of questions about what was changing in the way we fight, the way we operate, and particularly the role of information in that. And alongside the sort of digital explosion, the sort of the pervasiveness of information technology and the democratization, if you like, of information technology, that sort of set my brain off on, you know, what could be different and what needed to be different. So that's sort of, that was the start of the journey about 10 years ago. And I end up here in having this interesting job with a vast prospectus and challenge to help transform defense digitally, to take advantage of the benefits of the digital age and to mitigate some of the threats.
Well, we're going to come on to that. And see, I knew you'd do a better job than I would have done, Tom, which is why I asked you that question. I've got to ask this question. Did you always want to be a soldier?
So I'm afraid there are no great shocks here. I'm from a very military background, you know, the son, the nephew, the brother of soldiers. My aunts in the Second World War were the people who, you know, drove trucks around the country to, you know, I had an uncle killed in the Second World War. So, yes, I'm afraid I'm not going to shock anybody here. I'm a pretty stereotypical military family.
So no pressure on you whatsoever to follow the lineage of great soldiers.
Well, like many people, I think I probably fooled myself. I was looking at all sorts of other things. You know, I had a big thirst to be a journalist and this, that and the other. But no, looking back, I was fooling myself and that's where I was headed.
Yeah, I know how you feel. We had a couple of other barristers in the family and then suddenly I was a barrister. I have no idea how it happened, but here we are. So I understand that entirely. Now, just help people also understand the current role slash rank that you have so we can give them some perspective. So you're a Major General within the British Armed Forces now. So just help people understand the nature of that role.
Yeah, so being a major general, it's just a rank. I mean, it's a rank, but it's impressive sounding because it's got general attached to it. I suppose what's more important is I'm what's known as a two-star general.
Right.
And the only important thing for this context of that is that there's then a three-star and a four-star, and we used to have a five-star general. So before anybody thinks that I'm top of the pile, I'm still quite a way off the top of the pile. And I'm sure we'll want to discuss the sort of nature of hierarchical organizations in due course, but that's worth remembering, actually, that however impressive sounding the title, you're still quite junior to somebody. And that's, I think, the way of the world, isn't it?
Well, we're all on a journey, aren't we? And it's a constant journey. And you're right, we will come back to that, because one of the reasons I asked that question is because you're working in a hierarchy. But I know you and I are going to discuss hierarchy and matrix too. So let me just come on to the current role, because we're going to talk about information. But you as the Director of Military Digitization at the UK Strategic Command. So, how did that happen?
So it's a new role created by actually the Chief of the Defence Staff and the Permanent Secretary,
right,
to give our CIO, our Chief Information Officer, a bit of a hand with the military aspects, not least because our CIO, Charlie Forty, my boss,
yep,
came from a very industry background, 40-odd years, mainly with sort of BP and others. And in defence, we speak several foreign languages, actually, in defence. We're acronym rich. We have all sorts of different tribal customs and practices within the sort of Army, Navy and Air Force. And of course, what we do with information is right up at the most difficult edge of, what governments do with information.
Yes.
We wield this unique ability to use lethal force in defense of the country and its people. So I guess I was sent in to give Charlie a hand with those military aspects of what is otherwise just like any other government department or any other large corporation.
And when we first chatted a number of weeks ago, Tom, this really resonated with me. From a trial lawyer perspective of sometimes prosecuting and defending and trying to understand the information behind what might have been a critical decision, even maybe a decision, yeah, to deploy armed police on the streets of London, or as a police officer, what is the information I'm dealing with in the moment which is requiring me to take an action which I've got to be accountable for? So this is important stuff. And you and I chatted about information. You talked about information that was, you said, technical, and information that was psychological. So help us understand how you see the breakdown of information, because information is a label, but there are components, yeah, to it, aren't there?
So it's fascinating, isn't it? So where do I start with that? So the use of data, yep, informing our decisions with data. Now, in some ways, the military has always been good at that. We've taken intelligence very seriously. But at the same time, we have privileged certain forms of intelligence. So I think it was Churchill who, probably about 100 years ago now, said something about, we give more credence to a scrap of paper smuggled out of a distant kingdom in somebody's loincloth than we do with what's printed on the front page of the Times of London.
Right.
So that sort of privileging of something with top secret stamped in red on it, rather than the very obvious that is out there but doesn't have top secret stamped on it. So that's one aspect of where we've been good and where we've been not so good, where we've used data well and then we've ignored large amounts of data which might have told you just, what's going on in the outside world.
Right.
Then the information technical and psychological, that's different. So that's stolen from the Russians.
Okay.
And I'm not really one for giving them a platform, because I don't necessarily approve of everything they're doing at the moment. But I think it does simply illustrate, how you can have information that is, if you like, the ones and zeros flowing through the system, that technical aspect. And then information psychological is how those ones and zeros impact on human brains. And, fundamentally in defense, we're about changing behaviors. Now, we get a bunch of different tools to change people's behavior with. But, we use lethal force ultimately not to kill lots of people. We use it to threaten and to change people's behaviors. And so that blending of hard and soft power is absolutely achieved by communicating to people. And if there's no communication, you're actually not doing your job, because you're not going to change people's behavior unless you're communicating. So that information psychological is that connection between, the physical things you're doing and the connection with, It could be a president, it could be a prime minister, it could be a king, or it could be the average Joe in the street who has a vote.
Right.
And so that information psychologically is how you connect to them and say, look, we'd really rather you didn't do this, or we would really rather you did do this. And if you do or don't, there are going to be consequences. Now, does that make sense?
No, it does, Tom. And I have so many questions. These are inextricably linked, aren't they? And I remember, again, I'm going to a previous life where I was working with firearms commanders who would be trying to do their very best, sometimes on a pre-planned or a spontaneous firearms investigation, where they always feared those two words in a court, why now? As in, why did you deploy armed police officers on the ground at that moment in time? Because then lethal force may be used. So how do you deal with just the, and I used this phrase, didn't I, the fire hose of information, that when you're in a critical environment and you work in live theatre, that you have information coming at you from all angles, and it's in all forms, and it's overwhelming. How do you, as a leader sometimes, who must be the one who is truly accountable for deploying troops on the ground who can use lethal force, and I appreciate that's down to them, how do you just deal with that deluge of information in order to, in your own mind, think what is relevant, what isn't relevant, you know, what's super important, what isn't? I mean, how do you do that?
So it's tough, but this is as old as history, you know, this problem. And you'll remember in the past, we called this the fog of war.
Yeah.
And, you know, of course, in, let's say 200 years ago, you know, Wellington and Napoleon facing off on really quite a small piece of terrain against each other at Waterloo. The fog of war there was a physical thing as well as a virtual thing. So you literally had smoke, you know, black powder, smoke drifting across the battlefield. You literally had rain coming in horizontally into your face. You had the sounds of battle that are very disorientating and very hard to focus when you've got the sounds of battle. And of course, bits of hot metal whizzing around your ears. You know, that was then the fog of war. And then you had the pressure of, you know, as Wellington said, losing the army in an afternoon, you know, that ability to literally lose the whole of Britain's army if you made the wrong decision. So that was the fog of war 200 years ago. I think the fog of war today, well, at the front line, it's still very similar to that.
Yes.
But for senior decision makers, they're much more remote from the front line than they were 200 years ago. And now it is this blizzarding of information, you know, this huge ability to collect and process, sorry, to collect and distribute data.
Right.
But not necessarily matched by our ability to process it into valuable information to inform leaders. So now that fog of war feels far more like either too much information, so you can't sort of hear, as we would say, you can't hear the signal in the noise, or information that by the time it's processed is too late. So you're making the right decision, but you're making it too late to be right,
okay,
which is almost as bad as no decision. So those are some of the challenges. That's what it feels like. I haven't told you how to solve it yet, but that's what it feels like.
That's like the $64 million question, isn't it? If you can tell me how to solve that conundrum, Tom.
Yeah, so there's a technical answer to that, which I won't expand on today, which is all about your bytes, you know, the ability to create data being matched by your flops, your floating end operating systems or whatever. Anyway, the ability of your computing system to process that information. But let's leave that there for a moment, the technological piece. Let's just look at the human bits of that. You mentioned earlier hierarchical systems versus flat systems.
Yeah.
So one of the reasons that so many areas of life have moved to much flatter, more matrix-based systems is actually to get information processed and to decision makers much, much quicker. And probably more importantly, so everybody focuses on that, the sort of upwards movement of information to the leader. I think actually what's far more interesting is something we've always done when we've done it well in defense, which is to flatten the ability for the leader to give information downwards, to give context and what we would call strategic intent. This is where we're going. I'm not quite sure how we're going to get there, everybody, but that's where we're going. Now I'm flattening our structure so that you can tell me the best way to get there.
Yes.
Because you, the junior folk, are the ones in touch with the road. You're the ones in contact, as we'd say. And you can see, I don't know, to extend the geographic metaphor, you know, we're going there, but you can see the marshes and the swamps and the trenches and the so on. So you're going to tell me within that overall direction exactly how we're going to get there. So we focus on flattening structures very much from the bottom to the top. I'm far more interested in some ways how we flatten from the top to the bottom and change the nature of leadership from I'm telling you exactly how to do something to I've got a vague idea where we're going, but I need you, the people in touch with the road, to tell me exactly how we're getting there.
Now, there's a couple of things that come out of this, Tom, and I'll work backwards in my own head. And one of them is, you know, as a two-star general, you don't have all the answers, do you?
Absolutely not.
And how does that feel? Because as a senior leader, there is something vulnerable, there's something courageous, there's something humble about a leader now in any discipline actually saying to people, I don't have all the answers, but how can we together, how can we collectively work through or navigate the problem? At what point did that become obvious to you as a leader, it was okay to say to people, I don't know what, I'm not sure of the answer here. I can give us an idea of the general route or direction, but we're going to have to work this out. We're going to have to fix as we fly.
So hard to know. I guess the first time I noticed in a positive way was when I was commanding a company. So that's about 100 and something people strong.
Right.
And that would have been, I guess, 20 years ago now. And I remember we were deployed, actually, we were in Jamaica on an exercise, but also helping the Jamaica Defense Force with their own internal security training. And there were a bunch of things we need to achieve. And I remember my team coming to me with all sorts of suggestions, which were not what I'd suggested they should do. And you got that sort of slightly ego-driven response that said, that's not what I told you to do.
Right.
Followed swiftly by, wow, that's a better way of achieving what I told them we needed to do. And so you had that sort of slightly crushing sort of sense of, oh, okay, they've got better ideas than
me. Why didn't I think of that?
Why didn't I think of that? So it's great, isn't it? And once you get over that ego-driven, well, that's not what I said, then, you know, and it's what I call hovercraft leadership. So bear with me on this, but have you ever been in a hovercraft, Adam?
Once in my life, many, many moons ago.
Probably on the way to the Isle of Wight.
I think it probably was.
Yeah. So when you get in a hovercraft, and I'm not a hovercraft aficionado, but you'll recognize what I'm talking about. You get in the hovercraft and it's all sitting on the concrete. And then presumably, I think they call them a pilot in a hovercraft because it flies. He presses the button and the skirts inflate with air. Yeah, exactly. And then do you remember, as you get enough air in there, it skeeters around, and skeeter is not a technical phrase here. It's my phrase. It skeeters around and you feel, whoa, where's it all going? You know, and the hovercraft sort of judders around. And then presumably the pilot sort of pushes the tiller and it takes off, and there you are on the way to cows or, you know, wherever you're going. And it's that sense of reducing the friction with the ground that I got to when suddenly your subordinates are saying, hey, boss, you know, interesting ideas, but you said we wanted to get over there. The way you suggested getting there is a really bone idea. How about we do it this way? And you get that skeetering feeling. It's quite uncomfortable because suddenly you're not in control.
Right.
But then when you push the tiller forwards, boy, you move fast because you've reduced that surface friction. And, you know, we talk about empowerment. Suddenly the people working with you are empowered. You know, suddenly they are reaching out and they're prepared to say, boss, that was a bone idea. How about we do it this way? And boy, does the organization then move fast.
This is why I love this podcast, having conversations like this. So there's got to be an element, I'm assuming, Tom, of psychological safety, regardless of hierarchy and rank, so that more junior officers and as you say, members of the troop can actually say, boss, how about this? Or I'm not sure, and let me just tell you what I'm thinking. So there's got to be an element of that. But you also talked about something where we've worked with leaders on something called commander's intent, which I think you've already alluded to, was setting the commander's intent and then allowing them the autonomy and giving them the authority to now make the decisions in the live theater during the fog of war in order to try and carry out the intent. Is that a fair summary?
Completely. And so we, you know, because we write things down in defense, we're quite controlling that way. We actually have turned this into a theory, and it's called mission command.
Right.
And so why this is important is a mission, we would say, is a task and a purpose. So it's, Adam, I want you to assault that trench but you're doing it to achieve this overall purpose.
Right.
And what that gives you the ability to do is when you're busy assaulting that trench or, you know, clearing that trench, if you find that that trench is unoccupied and you don't have a trench to clear, but you can remember what the purpose was, which is actually you're clearing that trench so that the team alongside you can do this, you can actually, in the heat of battle, you can say, right, the task is no longer relevant. The purpose is still relevant. So I can actually assault that trench, or I can do this thing, or I can give supporting fire to the team on my right. And so that combination of task and purpose, so the task and the intent, is really important for empowering your subordinates. And you know, that is our command doctrine, mission command. And we do that on operations pretty well. I'm not saying perfectly. We do that pretty well. The interesting thing, of course, is when you come back to sort of large bureaucratic organizations not on operations, whether you can still keep that sort of empowerment, that sense of intent, that freedom, that risk-taking, whether you can keep that live. And that's a much more difficult thing.
Tom, this reminds me of a phrase that I had just come to the forefront of my mind now, tight loose, that you're tight in relation to the absolute imperative, the strategic imperative or the mission, but you're looser as regards how those now soldiers in the field can move forward and try and achieve that overall outcome. And I had a conversation last week with the global head of learning solutions at Takeda. Now, that's a huge pharmaceutical organization, 55,000 people, 240 years old, Japanese in heritage. And he used a wonderful phrase, and I'm seeing a correlation here. He said, the map forever changes, but the compass never does. And in some ways, that reminds me of what it is that you're saying in relation to the strategic command and imperative, but the flexibility of the people in order to operate to achieve it.
Yeah. So that idea of a North Star, so I mean, we would, again, we'd break that down into tell people what you want them to achieve and why you want them to achieve it. But if you can, stop short of telling them how to achieve it, because right, that gives them maximum latitude. Now, that all sounds very easy on a podcast, doesn't it? Clearly.
In the cold light of day, always easy.
In the cold light of day, all this is easy. I mean, clearly, and our doctrine of mission command has some very important riders, and there's some very important principles that underpin it. One of them is obedience, but that's obedience to the overall intent, but the ability to be disobedient to the specific task,
right,
and the how, if that makes sense. Another one would be that sort of ethical framework, which we build around what we do. You know, because we're using lethal force, we spend a huge amount of time, not an inordinate amount of time, a huge amount of time, thinking through what is the, you know, what is the appropriate way to behave in these circumstances. And so obedience to the laws of war or to, you know, to our ethics would be an absolutely important rider, because, you know, ultimately we are asking often very young people,
yeah,
to do things when they're very scared, where they're encountering situations where they couldn't possibly have encountered before, and for them to make the right choices within that freedom. And, you know, we have this phrase, which for me sums it up, you know, for people to do the right thing on a dark day when nobody is watching. So we talk about these freedoms. We talk about the need to be sort of coherently disobedient. But that is bound in by some very important ethical riders, which try and make sure that the right thing's done in very difficult circumstances.
Now, Tom, there may be leaders from all over the place listening to this, and I hope that's the case. Young leaders starting a new business, corporate leaders leading large global teams. How do you get people ready to walk into something where they've had no experience before? Yes, I appreciate a lot of training, but no experience before, where they're going to be operating right at the outer limits of human emotion. How do you get people ready for that? I mean, I had some experience of that, Tom, as an operational police officer, but I'll be honest with you, not operating right out there at those limits. How do you, how do you prepare somebody, yourself and others, for that?
Look, I mean, you'll recognize it a lot from what the police do, but clearly what our phrase is, you train as you mean to fight.
Right.
And so you try and make your training as realistic as possible. And, you know, there's all sorts of simulations that we use to do that. But also that means actually in your training going beyond the point of failure. So deliberately pushing people, not that they fail absolutely and break apart, but so that they have gone to a stage where they do the wrong thing, do not achieve the mission. And then, of course, you have to coach and mentor them that is going to happen and how to get yourself back up, because you might have lost that battle, but there's another battle coming tomorrow. And it might turn out that the battle you lost wasn't the critical battle, and winning the battle tomorrow is just important. So I think, high-performing teams, football teams, rugby teams, sports, any company that's doing well at the moment has had its failures. And you mentioned psychological safety earlier. Yeah. We refer to that as safe to fail. Right. And of course, turning your failure into learning is a critical part of this. So I think that's we in defense, we are basically a training organization, and where we're not on operations or fighting, we're training. Now, there's a much more interesting scope to that now, in that in a world of a gray zone where no longer is there nice separation between black and white, between peace and war, yeah. In this gray zone, a lot of the training you're doing is itself an operation. So you're training in a way that you are communicating to your adversaries and to your friends, we're up for this, or we're not up for that, or this is a red line, or this is not a red line, or we're alongside you as a partner and ally. And implicitly to our adversaries, we are getting ready if we need to respond to your actions. So even the gap between training and operations is narrowing down. And that's another feature of this sort of gray zone, this sub-threshold area that we're now operating in.
I talked to a chap called Nick Jankel, who's a futurist, no crystal balls involved, but certainly, they're helping others navigate what might be the opportunities and trends and the mega trends coming over the horizon. And he mentioned a phrase, which I remember, this is months ago now, continuous beta. And I know yeah. You and I chatted a few weeks ago about that agility in the army. And I think you talked about alpha beta. Remind me what were some of your thoughts on that.
Yeah, so it's, again, this is me as a soldier now entering yep. The world of sort of DevSecOps and software developers, and recognizing so much of the way they do DevSecOps, or even now MLOps, machine learning operations,
right. And
how we operate in the army. So we have a whole bunch of phrases. I mean, no plan survives first contact with the enemy. That's absolutely constant beta. So
that's like a strategy, corporate strategy.
Emergent strategy in the words of sort of management consultancy now. If in doubt, recce out. So, one of the first things you learn as a young officer, you've got some intelligence preparation that you do. You look at the maps and you read intelligence reports, but you could read them forever and never understand it all. So if in doubt, put a recce out. And that means getting some people on the ground to go and confirm your hypothesis. If you were trying to turn this into management speak, you've got an idea. You think that approaching from the right flank will be a good idea. Well, you're going to put a recce out to see what's on the right flank. And hopefully the corporal, the sergeant, or the young officer leading that recce, when he comes back and says, boss, the right flank is good to go, he's absolutely done the recce well, and there's not a minefield that he's leading into, and that they've got the confidence when they find the right flank was a really stupid idea, he can come back and say, boss, straight up the middle, lots of smoke today. Right flank's got a minefield in it. So, that wraps up exactly what you're saying. And that feels like constant beta, and that's exactly how software teams iterate. You start off with an idea that you can do something one way, and then you test and you test and you test again. And that's agility. Agility is not moving fast, like Usain Bolt. That's not agility. Agility is moving fast like Usain Bolt, but then changing direction very, very quickly, 10 meters into the 100 meters. I'm going to confuse the metaphor now, still ending up at the finishing line, but it's not a straight line. It's just not as easy as that.
Well, Tom, you're working in two worlds now, aren't you, of the British Armed Forces and digitization, which are, as you say, operating continuously in continuous beta. So in some ways, you've got a double whammy.
Yeah, so we talk at the moment about constant competition, and this is very much a feature of the multiple disruptions that are hitting UK and UK defence. So clearly, we are implicitly talking about the information age and the digital age. And that's interesting because it's not only a disruption, but it's a disruption of how we use information. So it's a sort of disruption squared, going back to your fog of war sort of thing. It's not just the world is changing, but the very way we see and put the world together is changing underneath our feet too, which leads to this sort of very difficult position for leaders. But look at the other disruptions, you know, hitting us. The rise of Asia is a pretty important thing. So, or the rise of the Indo-Pacific, or however you typify it. Yeah. COVID is a pretty massive disruption, as we discussed right at the start of this call. The demographic changes around the world. Climate change is a phenomenal disruption. And of course, they're all happening, compounding with each other. So the way, you know, the rise of Asia compounds with climate change, COVID will compound with climate change, and they're all being accelerated and amplified by the digital disruption that we're all going through and the rise of artificial intelligence. So, yeah, and then of course, for us in the UK and for the US as well, there's a move from a sort of unipolar world, that, you know, Pax Americanus that we'd recognized from the end of the Cold War, to a much more multifaceted world where, you know, we talk about a return to great power competition. And this, you know, that's not playing out in the hot zone. That's not playing out in binary terms. That's playing out in this gray space, this constant competition that we talk about. So, you know, that's why I suppose these DevSecOps, MLOps opportunities feel so natural, because they're in constant competition too, and they're iterating constantly to a better bit of code, a better solution, and always ready to throw out the old solution as you develop a new one. And not hold on to it just for emotional reasons.
It just reminds us, doesn't it, Tom, that everything is interdependent on everything else, that we talk about a matrix organization, but we're very much a matrix world, aren't we, where there's cause and effect on everything. And actually trying to navigate that, as well as the plethora of information that is out there and is coming to us, which is why it's so difficult for people to lead. And I keep coming back to that point that you mentioned about the leader can't have all the answers nowadays. Those days are gone. That very strict command and control, or very strict, let's all just defer to the leader who will then provide us with the answer. And then that's long gone, isn't it, really? All of that.
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, when people are scared and tired and wet and lonely, there will still remain requirement for when they turn round and look at the boss to be able to offer them solace. Now, whether that is giving them the answers, or whether that's saying, you know, you've still got it. It's all right. You know, we don't know the perfect answer, but together as a team, we're going to get through it. So I wouldn't undercut the role of leadership. All I would say is that leadership doesn't always come from the boss.
Yeah. Sometimes, and it's that human-centered, Tom. Well, you're also talking about that human-centered leadership, which is something I'm passionate about. That's what it sounds like you're referencing now. Right.
And so the bit I would pick out from that, I mean, clearly in the industrial age, we built these very vertical hierarchies and these siloed structures, because that was the way we made sense of chaos. Now, the world is just as chaotic, you know, entropy still reigns, but the information age has given us tools that we can flatten our structures, and we can collaborate over a much wider sphere. And, you know, we talk about constant competition, but it's also a time of constant collaboration. So, for instance, it's very public at the moment that we're not that happy with some of the things China's doing. And there's a sense of competition, and whether that's us, the UK or the US, you know, there are some niggles there. But we're also very clear that we must collaborate with China, and that we don't want it to become a confrontation. We want it to be a collaboration. And we aren't going to deal with climate change without collaborating with the same people we're competing with economically or in the information space. So that sense of collaboration and teamwork, and, you know, there's a famous American general, Stan McChrystal, who's become quite well known, who talks about teams of teams.
Teams of teams, great book.
That ability to collaborate, not just across your own silo, but with other silos, you know, across with other silos is particularly important, I think.
And it must be, you must come across that a lot, that need for you as the two-star general to be the human-centered leader when people are tired, wet, anxious, distraught, maybe in some ways, operating at the edges of their human capabilities. And what they need from you is that human-centered leader, if nothing else, to tell them it's going to be all right.
Yeah, that is right. And you know, that's... It's a balance that you never know if you've got quite right, you know, because you are yourself probably questioning things at that stage. And you mentioned vulnerability earlier. I mean, that's probably one of the biggest learnings I've had in my whatever 30-something-year career as a soldier now, you know, I certainly, when I joined, I thought leaders were, had to be perfect. You had to show what we would call the mask of command, you know, this absolutely immutable.
Yeah.
I'm in charge. I've got it. Don't worry. If it gets tough, I'll give you the answers, but meantime, crack on. And of course, you know, there was a time, and there's, you know, in some fields of life, that's still very much the vogue. But you suddenly realize that if you need your team to be empowered, then just looking over their shoulder, waiting for the boss to tell them what to do is no way to feel empowered. And to get them into that empowered sense, in some way, you've got to show just little bits, and I'm not going to overstress this, but little bits of vulnerability where they suddenly realize, God, the boss needs me just as much as I need him.
Yes.
And, you know, that took me quite a while to get to. I have to admit, you know, with no great pride, that took me a while to get to. And as I say, you're never quite sure. I mean, we're in defense, we would, you know, there was an old phrase in the army anyway, familiarity breeds contempt.
Yeah.
You know, that was the phrase that reminded you as a leader that you need to maintain this gap between the leader and the led. And I still think that's probably true. Familiarity does breed contempt. But equally, you've got to test the boundaries a bit. And unless you get it wrong a few times, you're probably not in touch with your team to the extent that you need to. So I'm not advocating we break down every sort of differential or anything else. But you've probably got to get it wrong a few times to know where the line is and to know how to relate to your team.
We're really talking about balance, aren't we, here, in relation to that aspect, Tom. And there's something else I want to ask you about, and in some ways I'm coming full circle, back to information again and the glut of information. Now, many organizations, many professions are still working on their diversity, whether it's the armed forces, whether it's the police, whether it's the legal field, accountancy. But you were speaking to me a couple of weeks ago where you said we need different people to be able to see information through a different lens, and that diversity of thought is something that's really important to how we navigate information. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So clearly, you know, this is a podcast, so your listeners won't know I am male, pale, stale. I'm double-barreled as well, for what it's worth. You know, I guess you could say I'm diversity negative. You know, I'm sort of all the bits that shouldn't be protected and aren't protected and that are privileged. And we're doing a huge amount of work on that in defense to make sure that particularly those protected characteristics, that those bits mandated by law, you know, that we do bring into the workforce. And that's right and good. And it, you know, and the team I work in at the moment in Defence Digital, you know, is just a great example of how we're getting it right, frankly. You know, whether it's gender or orientation or anything else, we're a bit pale in fairness at the 2-star level, but better at 1-star level. You know, that's a pretty good story to tell. But what you point to there is, you know, that different ways of thinking about a problem don't necessarily always come with those legal protected characteristics. And what you want when you're solving problems is people with very different mindsets. And, you know, there's quite a lot of focus now on neurodiversity.
Right.
And literally the different way people's brains are put together and the different way they approach problems is increasingly important in solving wicked problems. You know, those uber connected system of systems problems that we have, where it's very rare that there's just one answer. You know, it's suddenly the clouds part and there's a flash of light and you see, the answer's 27. Just not like that. So you need these very diverse teams of teams with all of those protected characteristics, but critically as well, cognitive diversity.
Yes.
People can think differently about the same problem and bring different solutions. And again, you know, I go back to my training as a young officer. I said, if in doubt, recce out. Well, when you do a reconnaissance, you do a thing, what we call rose petaling.
Okay.
So you go out and round. So think of a rose petal. Yes. for the listeners at the moment. You go out and round, you come in on the objective, have a good look at it, and then you go back out again so you don't alert the enemy. And then you come around, look at it from another direction. Then you go back out, come in, until you build a 360 view of the, you know, the place you're about to attack or whatever else it is. So rose petal. And for me, this is just rose petaling. It's getting simultaneous different views, different lenses, different viewpoints on the same problem, and then putting them all in the pot to see, come on, what's the best solution? Or what are the several best solutions? What are the three hypotheses we're now going to test and experiment with? And really, that's what you're after, those multiple lenses on a problem.
Yeah.
Because that leads not just to better solutions, but also to more resilient solutions. When the first solution you settle on turns out to be wrong, you've still got some other options in the bag to then test and keep going.
And this is so transferable to leaders and leadership. So this has been jam-packed full of sound bites as well, which is great. I love rose petaling. I also love that, if in doubt, recce out. I'm going to be using that phrase. Where did you get that from? I said, I'm not going to tell you. I've got a final question for you. And by all means, pause and think about the answer to this one. And for you, it's about what would be front of mind for you about the strongest or most influential piece of leadership advice you've ever given or received. What comes front of mind for you, Tom?
So that's interesting. I mean, I've been blessed, you know, by working for, with, having worked for me, some fantastic people.
Yeah.
And I've been blessed with so much advice that I'm afraid we'd have to do another podcast to get through it all.
Be careful what you wish for, Tom.
I think The one I'd settle on, though, yep, is when I was going to take command of a battalion, which is about 700-odd people, wow, 700 to 1,000-odd people, an old boss and friend of mine wrote me and he was coming back from a tour. It was New Year's Eve, mm-hmm, and he bothered to stop off in Dubai when he was on the way back to see his kids and write me a 2-page email, right, of advice, because it's the only time he was going to have. So there's, wow, a lesson in there about people bothering to mentor. And he gave me lots of good advice, but at the bottom he said, above all, Tom, he said, command like it's your last 2 years in the army, and knowing you, it probably is. and so, you know, what he was saying there was, you know, what Field Marshal Bill Slim said, commanding the 14th Army in Burma in World War II, the forgotten army, leadership is just plain you. And that changes over time. If you're on your learning edge, because, yes, you're constantly learning, you're constantly, correct, making mistakes. But where you are right now, you need to go for broke and you need to be just plain you. And if you do that, if you are authentically you, you'll get a lot of things wrong. But at least the people working with you, alongside you, above you, will recognize it's you and it's authentic. And that then allows them to be authentic too. And, you know, that builds an inclusive team, not just of a diverse team. And I think it was Lord Brown of BP who used to say, if you want diversity, start with inclusion. Because if you have an inclusive team, you'll get that diversity.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
And, you know, I think that's why authentic leadership is so important. If you're authentic, your people will feel able to be themselves, to bring their whole selves to work. And then you build that sense of inclusivity. And from that, you can do everything.
Wow. Well, what an amazing place to end this episode. I hope you've had fun and enjoyed. Is that the right way of enjoyed? Certainly the Leadership Enigma. This one is jam-packed. I'm looking forward to editing this and releasing this as well. Tom, I hope you've enjoyed the experience.
Thanks very much, Adam. Thank you so much.
And you did offer, didn't you? We'll have to come back and have another conversation about all of the great leadership advice that you've had over 30 illustrious years. That'll be podcast number two. Listen, it's absolutely brilliant. You're a star. Thanks very much for being a superb guest on the Leadership Enigma.
Join us again next week for more tips and strategies on the Leadership Enigma. We'd love to hear your comments on today's show, as well as suggestions for future topics and guests. Get in touch with your host on LinkedIn or our YouTube channel. And remember to get your daily learning to build success at www.insights.emeritus.org. Download the Insights app and start learning for free. Please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe on all your major podcast platforms. Thanks for listening.